This program is brought to you by Jewel, sous vide by Chef Steps. Jewel takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on Heritage Radio Network. Extremely late today because we had our weekly China call, which we can't do on Tuesdays anymore, Nastasia. To be more precise, to our team in China. We're not calling the
entire country.
Yeah. From Burst Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah? We got Matt in the booth. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yep. Call in your questions, but make them brief because we only have
20
minutes. Whatever today.
It's going to be a quick one.
718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So after the radio program today, Nastasia, we need to do some Bob's Red Mill talking. Specifically, they want me to talk about amaranth flour and sorghum flour. Mm-hmm. But you know what I'm super sick of in general? I'm sure, Nastasia, you hate this as well.
Doing ads?
Oh, no. I mean, like, whatever. Gotta pay the bill. I don't know why we gotta pay the bills, honestly. But we have to pay the bills. But, no, but, like, when someone gives you a recipe for, like, a gluten-free flour, what do they always freaking say? What's the thing they always say?
It tastes just like regular flour.
No, they never say that because it's untrue. What do they say?
I don't know.
Matt, do you pay attention to the world? Nastasia clearly doesn't.
No, I'm on her level.
It's like she's not even in the food business. It's crazy.
I have to say,
Nastasia... Okay, so we were on this call.
She's in the hospitality business. She cares about people.
Well, that's not what I heard this morning on the telephone.
It's an employee.
Because, yeah, so he's not people. So Nastasia, calls into this call with China, which is, by the way, hard enough to hear because they're connecting on Skype. And, like, I don't know whether the, you know, Chinese mainland government isn't slick enough to not, like, when they're listening in on whatever our engineer is saying. Like, his connection is the worst connection in the universe, constantly. We can never hear what he's saying, ever. Nastasia, meanwhile, is on speakerphone in the middle of a New York City street
because
she's walking to Pasta Flyer, whatever.
With me and I couldn't do the call in my house.
Because you didn't want them to hear? They might steal your ideas?
They were still sleeping.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I know.
So then she shows up and she starts yelling at her employee, like worse than I yell at my kids when it's, like, the same F-up they've done every... She's like...
Well, the thing is that he's mopping in the dark. Mopping the restaurant front of house in the dark.
He does it by feel.
No. And then I'm like, hey, person's name. He has his headphones on so loud he cannot hear me. So that just raises my anger level.
Yeah. Well, of course, as far as he knows, he's there alone. So why wouldn't he?
Mopping in the dark.
The dark is
dumb.
No.
I walked in and I was like, hey. And then I sat down to do the call. And then I was like, it's dark.
Yeah, but the tone of voice Nastasia used, like, honestly, if I was that dude, I would have been like, this lady wants me to quit. I'm going to quit right now.
you should have heard me talk to UPS.
Oh, my God. Nastasia should have been arrested for what she said to UPS.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, you're not allowed to physically threaten people. Although, good news, Amazon is going to have 3 headquarters, not just 2. They're going to have their Seattle headquarters or wherever in the hell they are. And then, remember, they were going to have their countrywide search for where they were going to put their second headquarters? Well, they decided to do 2. One outside of Virginia and one, Nastasia, in Long Island City. Mm. So now you can physically go over there and choke out somebody at Amazon. People, here's, like, a good health tip. Like, do not do business with Nastasia and then move within choking range. She will find you. I can't believe that you weren't... that no police showed up at your door after the threats you made to the UPS
people. That's
the
first time I felt bad about things I said.
I believe you have a caller.
Oh, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave, it's Jay from Alden again.
How you doing?
I'm good. So I picked up the Cooking Around the World series that you
Oh,
legend?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Time Life one? The one from early 70s? Yeah, great, right?
Yeah, I've read 10 of the volumes. But right now I'm making the SEMA beverage, like some lemon-flavored mead from Scandinavia.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, you never made it, right?
No.
Basically, it's just lemon, sugar, and active dry yeast.
Okay, but so it's sugar, so it's not a mead. It's like, it's got...
Yeah, I know. It's like, why did they say mead? But next time I might use honey.
Yeah, but, although we should get that mead guy back on from Enlightenment Wines. I mean, the thing is that obviously if it's Scandinavian, back in the... You ever read Beowulf? There's mead all up and down in Beowulf. It's all everywhere. The mead bench.
No, but I've read other things.
Yeah.
So you would have no idea how much ABV it will turn out to be.
Oh, that's an easy calculation to do if you're using white sugar. I don't happen to know it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But you can just look up, Brix to potential alcohol, and then you can just convert the sugar to potential alcohol, because this is a thing that brewers worry about constantly. So, or anyone that is doping in sugar. I just don't happen to have it off the top of my head. I know that when I ferment orange juice, I ferment pretty much, I have to add sugar to it, and it starts out at around 11 Brix, so 11% sugar by weight, and I have to add sugar to it. So it's not 1-to-1. So if you want, let's say, 8% alcohol, you're going to need more than 8% sugar, I think. But again, it's been a long time since I run the calculations, but that's an easily knowable thing on any one of the brewers' sites, Brix to potential alcohol scale is what they call it, because they don't know if you're going to ferment dry or not. So obviously any residual sugar that you leave is potential alcohol that you didn't convert.
Okay, So what I'm doing right now is lemon. I was thinking about other varieties once I get started, and well, probably using citrus would be like pretty simple.
Orange is good. I mean, the good thing about orange is the residual acidity that's in orange juice is nice, and the residual, I use clarified, of course. I've never tried unclarified, and the residual bitterness that's in clarified orange juice is nice once it's fermented dry. It doesn't tend to last, so you can't, the flavor of it, I didn't like as much when it had been aged for, 3-4 months as when it was, fresher on the order of like a couple of weeks old after the initial primary is done. The one problem, if you haven't done a lot of fermenting before, is you'll probably have a tendency to make it too acidic on the beginning. And then once it ferments dead dry, it's going to be extraordinarily tart because the sugar will be gone. Unless you don't ferment it dead dry. You could do a partial fermentation, in which case residual acidity is more your friend, if that makes sense.
By fermenting it dead dry, this is the first time I'm making any sort of alcoholic beverage. What do you mean?
Well, so like the sugar that's in there, right? As you convert it to alcohol, then there won't be any more. That sugar will be gone away. So, do ciders and other things, I tend to try to ferment almost all of the sugar away. Other people, for instance, there's techniques in cider making called keeving, and there's all sorts of techniques to try to stop the fermentation at some point mid-cycle so that there's residual sugar. But, and sometimes things will just get stuck, so there'll be a lot of residual sugar. Like the fermentation will just end for, a number of reasons. The yeast is inhibited by something, or in fact, honey, a lot of mead, first time mead makers will have problems with their distillation. It's called getting stuck. And so you'll end up with a higher, proportion of sugar and less, therefore, alcohol. But if you are going to ferment something until it is completely dry, so until all the sugar is gone, then just have to take into account the fact that, the acidity will taste, much more present than you might expect.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, another quick question. What's your best recommendation as to an inexpensive meat grinder?
Ooh, I don't have a good one. I have the KitchenAid one, and I don't really like it. I hate it. right? Some people buy that.
I once made mortadella with it.
Yes, no good.
Never doing that again.
Yeah. Some people use that, I believe it's Czech, I think, that like one that was built, the old one, the hand grinder that's, you know, like a casting.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't have any good luck with it. I should research inexpensive grinders.
You grind meat a lot?
I mean, I just deal with garbage. I mean, like, in other words, the stuff that I do when I grind it, I just don't like it. I just think it's low quality.
It's painful. The only thing you're using is the KitchenAid attachment.
Yeah, it's garbage. It's just wretched.
Okay, all right.
So you have to cut them, you know, like the thing with the KitchenAid attachment is it smears so easily, so you have to like cut things into long strips. I mean, everyone that owns a real grinder loves it. People like, so I've used, for instance, the inexpensive sausage stuffers from places like Grizzly, right, which is a catalog, and it works fine. It's not as well put together as the more professional ones, like the welds are really crappy and the grinds on the welds are really crappy, so presumably it's more difficult to sanitize. They also have relatively inexpensive grinders that may be good. I just don't have any personal experience with
them. What's the brand name?
Well, like a catalog that sells that stuff is Grizzly. The Grizzly. Like they're mainly a tool company, but they also cater to hunters, right? And so hunters have to process a lot of sausage, so they have sausage. I don't have to, but they do. So they have things like sausage stuffers and meat grinders, and they tend to be cheaper than Bass Pro, which also sells these things, or Cabela's, which also sells these things. So, you know, like once it's being sold into a professional kitchen, the prices go way up. But when it's sold to a hobbyist or a hunter or something like this who still has the need for professional grinding abilities, the price can come way down. Now, the quality probably also comes down, but if you're not using it every day in service, then it's probably not, you know, not that big of a deal. But, you know, I doubt you're going to have anything that's going to, you know, rival like the, you know, the butt-kicking Hobarts that, you know, we had back at the school. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, if you have any good experience, tweet it over to me. Let me know what you get.
I made an amazing mortadella, even though it should have turned out like 7 years ago.
Yeah. Well, all right. You know, look, if you're doing a small amount, so you can get away with almost anything, you know? Anyway, good luck with it.
This program is brought to you by Joule Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I'm the executive director of HRN and a real-life Joule user. I use Joule to help me host the most delicious dinner parties. When you cook with Joule, there's zero guesswork. So steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The paired app is super intuitive and has a great visual doneness guide. Joule is awesome for prepping many perfect portions, making it easy to cook for a crowd, and it's hands-free so you can focus on entertaining while Joule does the work. And pro tip, Joule is also great for travel. I throw mine in my suitcase if I'm headed to a rental house with any kind of uncertain kitchen. From perfect steak to juicy, tender Thanksgiving turkey, Joule makes the best food you've ever tasted. Just be sure to save some room for mini jars of pumpkin pie. Joule, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Joule and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/Joule, code HRN.
Dave, we got another question from the internet.
Oh, what is it?
It says, hello, Nastasia and Dave. This is from Sam in Chicago. Love the show. Looking for an alternative to the sous vide turkey this year. You mentioned a method where you spatchcock the bird, lay it over a pile of stuffing, and blast it in a hot oven. I've listened to every episode, and I can't remember if it was a new one or an old one. I can't find this spec. Would you mind going over this again?
Sure. So you can do, depending on how much you take out, you're going to speed up the cooking more or less. But if you're willing, see, the thing about it is you can make something that looks relatively bird-shaped. The thing that I don't like about a lot of like the classic kind of roulade things is they don't end up looking like birds, which is okay if you're a French person, but not okay if you're doing an American kind of a Thanksgiving. So what you can do is just cut along the backbone, and you can cut along the backbone kind of on either side, and rip it out. And then you can even rip out some of the you can rip out, you know, the internal carcass of the bird there. And it's a lot easier than doing, for instance, when I was doing the turkey where I'd have to put the exoskeleton in, I would have to do what's called inside-out boning, where you'd roll the bird apart and remove the skeleton without making a cut in the meat at all. And that takes a long time on a turkey, a lot longer than it does on a smaller bird like a quail, especially if you have Nastasia Lopez sitting next to you, pestering you about how long it's taking. Remember how mean you were to me, Nastasia?
Yes.
She's like, it's taking you a long time, Dave. It's taking you a long time on like a freaking frozen freaking turkey trying to inside out bone it so it looks good on TV. And Nastasia is doing nothing but sitting there. Nastasia is very good at sitting there and pushing your buttons while you have a sharp knife in your hand. She's the worst. Worst. Anyways, so this is much easier. You just cut out the backbone and then like kind of pry it open. Snap the joints at the legs and at the wings. Rip out those bones. You can take out, you know, you can leave the rest of the bones in, really. But then, so you have those bones now. You can roast them off and make a gravy with them, which is what I would do. So then you make a stuffing shaped kind of mound. I mean, sorry, a bird cavity shaped mound. On you know, on a tray or whatever, and then you roast that or cook it. Or what I typically do is I'll make a bag and I'll make like a plug, like sous vide almost of that, and I'll cook the stuffing as its own kind of thing, like a football. And then I'll have it hot, really hot, like, you know, hot, like, you know, steaming temperature. And then you'll have your bird, and because you've taken all the bones out, it's going to cook relatively quickly. Also, the stuffing is already at cooking temperature, so you don't need to get it hot. It's already hot, and it's already been made safe. Then you can drape the bird over the stuffing in the shape of a bird. By the way, you can also have brined it already, injected brine into the breast and whatnot, and you can drape it and dried it if you want. You should dry the skin. Drape it over the stuffing, and it cooks relatively quickly. Not as quickly as like the actual flat-pressed spatchcock against a sheet tray, which is the absolute fastest way to cook it, but it's, again, then it's going to look like a flat turkey and not like a turkey from Thanksgiving. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. The internets. All right. Let's get to the questions that were written in. This is from Gaz Herbert. I am writing after having done some research on peppercorn infusions, for which there seems to be little material online, especially in the gastronomic applications I'm interested in. It occurred to me that you may know about this stuff after reading through Liquid Intelligence. I mean, I have a pepper infusion in the book, Nastasia. Not that Nastasia.
I remember it.
You remember me making it. You've never opened the book once.
No, I've never opened the book.
I mean, I don't know. Did you ever?
No, I read my.
The paper itself is not useful as toilet paper or as a Kleenex.
I read my thank you.
You looked to see whether I had thanked you or not, and that was it. So she's opened the first three pages. Miracle. I love your use of interesting spices and relate to your perfectionism here at Ikoyi, a West African fine dining restaurant in London. My question is, when it comes to infusing peppercorns and spices in non-alcoholic solutions, such as milk or water, what is the ideal temperature and time for infusion, and what, scientifically speaking, are the consequences of going above or below this temperature/time? Take as an example peppercorns, cloves, and star anise, which, by the way, our friend Leanne Wong has said was her porn star name, which is amazing, right? Star anise?
No, she said it would be star anus.
Well, just mispronouncing anise, well, aren't you? We had another woman at the French Culinary who used to mispronounce something in a horrifying
Jesus,
way.
Yeah.
I can't say it online. That. I mean, but like literally whenever she opened her mouth and said these words, Nastasia and I were like, boom.
Let's just say she would travel to a certain country.
Yeah, yeah.
Mispronounce it.
But mispronounce it in the most horrible way. And it was like... It was like, you know, when you see the shock waves and you see the skin like in slow-mo and like the cheeks are like getting flapped over, like when they do those explosion slow-mos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like that. Yeah, Nastasia was like, oh. Anyway. Star anise. Where are we? Infusing into milk. Would 90 degrees centigrade for 2 hours be too high, too long? All the best. So look, a lot depends. Let me tell you what the variables are. First of all, milk, whole milk, by the way, or as my grandpa liked to say, milk, because he did not admit that skim milk was, in fact, milk. And he lived to be 98. So there you have it. Although that's such a dumb argument. I hate people who make arguments with like an N of one. So there I am, self-hate, right? Anyway, whatever. So the point being that milk is a good choice because it has some fat, and a lot of these spices, especially specifically black pepper, the actual nice flavors in it, like piperine and all the other good kind of aromatic volatile stuff, not extremely soluble in water. Which is why, and also it's volatile stuff. So Jeffrey Steingarten, you know, our friend Jeffrey Steingarten, who, by the way, all the younger people out there, if you haven't read The Man Who Ate Everything, you should go ahead and read that. Seminal book in its subject, and, you know, very early person of that kind. And, you know, kind of a curmudgeon, and, you know, more than kind of a curmudgeon.
In the best ways.
Yeah, and the worst, best and worst. I love him. Love myself from Jeffrey Steingarten. Anyways, point being, he was like, Dave, why do you add pepper early on? In he would just call Nastasia and me and just yell at us for our practices, even though he had, like, we would not have seen him in like a year, and he would just call us and start yelling at us, right, Nastasia?
So we'd see the number come up on our phone and be like, it's your turn.
Yeah, because we knew that it was going to be like 8 hours of him yelling at us about X, Y, or Z. He's like, Dave, why do you add pepper early on in cooking? All that's left at the end is the bitterness and none of the great aromatics. Why don't you add it at the end? And I was like, Jeffrey, I like those bitter notes. Why can't I add it two times? He had no response, right? Mm-hmm. So the problem with pepper is, one, a lot of, especially in things like soups, is a lot of those like awesome aromatic compounds are, one, volatile, and two, not super soluble in water. They should be more soluble in the fat, in the butter fat that's in milk, I think, right? So then there's two things that are going on. There's loss of volatiles because the stuff's like literally evaporating, right? There's a loss of volatiles because it's also just not infusing into whatever liquid you're using. And then there's the actual destruction of the of those flavors and aromas due to the heat. So you know, you have to separate some of these things. So in a sealed system where there's no air, right, it might be possible to have a higher temperature, and because you're not volatilizing anything because it's sealed, maybe it's possible to keep those things in solution if they actually want to dissolve into it, right? So you might run into a situation there where it's good. So 90 degrees C in milk on a stovetop, you probably will have evaporated a lot of those volatiles and they won't be there. Right. So I read a study that even just your grinding temperature that you use, right, if you grind refrigerated or frozen pepper with dry ice, black pepper, versus grinding it at a higher temperature because of the friction of grinding, like let's say 50 degrees Celsius, results in a huge loss in the volatile components, presumably to the atmosphere because you can smell them, right? Not presumably due to autolysis where the stuff is breaking itself apart. So I think, in other words, it might be possible in a sealed container to get a decent higher temperature extraction of pepper, but I don't know for sure. You'd have to run some tests. The other thing you could do is try to do infusions under high pressure at lower temperatures, even in the milk, in something like an EC, under, you know, high pressure, like, you know, 10 bar or so, 10, 11 bar, something there, right? And then you could do a side-by-side with it with heat. But that's the whole thing. It's like doing the side-by-sides and kind of seeing what you get. Not yet. We still have 9 minutes.
They have a show at 1, and you have to record
ads. Cat's not even here yet.
She's right there.
She's right here, and you do need to record those ads. Yeah.
All right, one thing I'll say before we go on. Nick wrote in and asked for the spec on the vodka Cranustino. It is, I believe, 5-1 cranberry, fresh cranberry to vodka. It might be 4-1, but I believe it's 5-1. And then just blend it with SPL, spin it out. The buttered popcorn rum is literally just, you know, pour, like, air pop some popcorn, pour the rum over it. You know, I think it's, you know, it's a lot. If we just do it, let it sit there for like 2-3 hours, strain it off, press the hell out of it, melt butter, keep the butter, you know, stir it in. It doesn't take that much butter, frankly. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. Stir it, let it stay liquid with like a, what's it called? Immersion circulator, for overnight, covered, so you're not losing anything, and then, freeze it and strain it off. And then, someone was going to try to make activated charcoal with rye bread. But I don't think it's going to work. And I'll talk more about it next week, Kevin. But activated charcoal is very difficult to make. And I would look at the books there are online on activated charcoal, how different and complicated it is from just plain charcoal. And once you turn into charcoal, it won't taste like rye bread anymore unless it's just something you really want to do. Now, on to Bob's Red Mill, because what we started to talk about at the beginning of the show, we never finished. And can we just bleed this into the ads, Matt, or no?
No.
But anyway, what I was going to try to get Nastasia to say that I hate is when people are like, you could just add it to pancakes or muffins. Anytime someone has a gluten-free flour, they're like, just make way with your pancakes, muffins, cookies. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's irritating. Because, like, obviously, you know, I do that all the time. I add oats to my pancakes and all, but it's not interesting. So I've been trying to work with these products to try to see if I could make something that is interesting. But anyway, I have not 100% successful yet, but I have run a lot of tests. I was working on a Scrapple, a sorghum-based Scrapple, sorghum-based biscuits, and Jowar roti stuff. But anyway, so we'll talk about it later. More next week. I got to record some ads, make some money. Bob's Red Mill, cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.